Du lyssnar på Shahin.
Och Sara. Varmt välkomna till Konfliktpodden. Konfliktpodden.
Let's start. Let's welcome Claudio Lanza to our podcast, which is called Konfliktpodden in Swedish, means the pod, conflict podcast in English.
Great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
We wanted to start with introducing our audience to you a little bit.
Your name is Claudio Lanza, and you come from Italy. We just learned that you're actually based in Naples or Napoli, and that's where you're from. You're a doctoral researcher or a PhD researcher at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of Westminster. And you study peace studies and international relations, and more specifically, you focus on rivalry. And in that work, you also focus on the conflict in Northern Ireland. You're also an academic research lead at an organization called Filia. And we will ask you a bit more about Filia later, but Filia is a community-driven leadership initiative working for equality and justice globally. And yes, that's our presentation of you. Do you feel like we missed something or you want to add anything?
I think it's very accurate. I would add that as a hobby, I like to eat ice cream. But I guess it's not really a hobby.
So
it depends on what level you do it.
It can be pretty hard. So we can say it's a hobby.
How often do you eat ice cream, would you say?
As often as I can keep myself and my body healthy. And so this standard has changed over time. Now it's once a week. One of my best friends worked in that sector.
In the ice cream sector?
Yes.
Okay.
In the ice cream sector. Yeah. That's a real resource to have among your acquaintances.
Yes. Yes. Unfortunately for my body, but fortunately for my heart.
And your soul.
Yes.
How old are you, Claudio?
I am 29, entering into the famous 30s this year. Not so thrilled to join the club, but I guess in a way it's good, it's positive. I'm waiting for my birthday in the spring. Hopefully lockdown is going to be less restrictive.
Yes, I hope you get to have a vaccinated birthday. That would be awesome.
Wow, that's interesting. Mm. I can ask for this kind of
This vaccine, jab. Yeah, exactly. Vaccine parties are going to be the best. Well, thank you for adding the ice cream hobby to your presentation, and I'm sorry for missing it in my initial presentation.
We have some further questions to let our audience know you a little bit more on a personal level. One question we have to you is, if you had to choose a superpower, what superpower would you choose and why?
Reading into people's minds, I guess, because that would make my work so more effective, and I would be like a billionaire. I actually encountered this question again and again in my kind of professional life, and this is the first time actually answering it with such a purpose that I really feel this is the real answer. Reading people's minds.
How do you use it to become a billionaire?
Well, you see, one of the things about learning and studying conflicts is, you know, understanding how listening to others is important, but it's also very tough. And so if you can have a deeper level of listening to their own mind, then you can, I wouldn't say influence them better, but definitely you can understand their motive better. And we are still trying to find a way to understand whether animals talk to each other. Maybe with this superpower it could be the science guy who actually discovers that.
Dr. Doolittle.
There you go.
And talking about animals, if you could compare yourself to any animal, which one would it be and why?
Good question. An animal. So, well, I always loved dogs. I think the way they experience love and give love, I think it's a life-changing experience. When you are capable of just unconditional love, and also the power of forgetting so often whatever happened. I mean, these two things, I think, make their life such an amazing experience. Then they don't have restrictions of, you know, they don't have to work. They just have to love others so they get fed. Sounds like a great life.
What an unexpected deep answer to that question. Yeah. That was awesome.
That was really good. And then I was like, is that the superpower I would like to have? ability to forget so quickly.
Wow.
That was deep.
Yeah, that was deep.
Now that we know you a little bit better, we know that you love ice cream, we know what superpower you would like to have. Let's get started with some of the questions about your research. But actually, I have a question based on what superpower you wanted to have, because you said that one really important thing in studying conflict transformation or working with conflict transformation is the ability to listen. So what is it that makes it so hard to be a good listener?
It is hard because I think listening or deep listening is about making space for the other. And so it's sacrificing your own self and just focusing all your attention to somebody's needs. It's not about just making space for the other, but also to not put yourself in the picture. And so I guess this is linked to also mediation in general. And when you want to mediate, it's about the actors, the people that you want to facilitate their relationship. It's not about you. And in our life, it's always about us.
Yeah.
Even our work is about us. I think the switch is so difficult because we have our needs and our desires. It's a bit paradoxical because on one hand, you have this greater knowledge that you want to use to enable others to find the solution, but you're not the one who's giving the solution. You're preparing the ground. And so you can, it can go to the point where you just want to say to these people, but you really should look at this. You know, this is actually the real important thing. Listen to yourself, but that's when you're doing too much. So I that does resonate with me.
When you started talking about listening, it sounded like you made a difference between listening and deep listening. Is that true? And what would you say is the difference?
I think it's the level of sacrifice that you are committed to make. So you know, when you hear something, it's a bit superficial. I think listening, in my understanding of it, you're focusing on what's happening, what's going on. And I think deep listening is not about you anymore. Your role there is to reflect back what you have listened to. So it's not about you. And I think when you're listening and you are reacting, there is something about you, right? So that's how I understand it. That's why I made this. So the reaction in deep listening is just a reflection of what the other has said.
So do you want to tell us, Claudio, a little bit about what you are studying right now? And when you tell us that, why do you think that it is relevant?
Yes, with pleasure. I am focusing on a very important concept, which is, and actually it's a phenomenon and underappreciated and underestimated in real life, which is rivalry. Usually think about rivalry as something that happens between politicians. In the media, we always hear about politicians, you know, they have rivals and they are striving to find a particular job or to get a particular job. But actually, rivalries are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. And they happen between individuals, groups, states. And I'm studying it because, precisely because of this reason, they are ubiquitous everywhere, but underestimated. Underestimated because rivalries have a distinctive feature, and it's about their frequency that makes them so problematic and their long-lasting character. So different to any kind of conflict, rivalries last longer and they are more frequent. And they are ubiquitous everywhere. They have the power to make our life miserable. And so there is so much potential in being able to deal with rivalries. That's why I'm focused on
that. And we will deep dive a bit into what you just said about that rivalries can make you miserable and that they are everywhere in a minute. But I just wanted to ask as well, why did you choose this field of study? And for how long have you known that you wanted to study rivalry or conflict transformation?
They are linked. So since I was a little guy, a little boy, I was always fascinated by political science, the science of politics, some people would say. I had so many conversations in my family with my father. My father always loved politics. I mean, he loves politics still. And so we constantly talked about problems, community problems, problems of our society, Italy. And so we always had, you know, conversations on potential solutions. And so we always kind of discussed these different solutions. And so there were times, and out of these discussions, I learned two things. So first, that when you are genuinely trying to solve a problem, you can find a middle ground. And so this was really inspiring. Secondly, if you don't listen to each other, it's all about arguing at each other. And so I, out of these discussions with him, I think I had nurtured this desire of making the middle ground possible. And so at first I wanted to become a diplomat. Then there was a journey in Norway, and I did my Erasmus at the University of Tromsø, and there is a center for peace studies there, and it changed my life. After that, I said I had to deep dive into one particular kind of conflict, which I believe diplomats are not really good at, and that's rivalry. So I switched from being a practitioner, let's say, a political level, to preparing the tools for then practitioners to actually find that middle ground, because I felt that something was missing.
I understood that your father was a politician, was he?
Yes.
My view of politicians might not be that they're trying to find the middle ground, or that they're good at like having a dialogue and like understanding each other's point of views, but it sounded like maybe, or was it like that your father taught you this skill almost, or was it your discussions with your father that led you to feel this way?
It was more out of the discussion with my father. And I think politics is different if you experience it at local level. There's less at stake, definitely less money, less prestige, less status. And so, and the issues are small, and usually with a pragmatic approach, you tend to solve them. Whatever it is the issue, you can find a different approach, but it was more after the conversations with him and the fact that, you know, I had my own ideas and it was interesting to discuss with him. And if I learned through those discussions certain things about politics, also about, you know, how to make good decisions happen.
I also find this idea of understanding why people are interested in finding a middle ground, I think, is really interesting, because it's easier to understand why people want to confirm or further their own idea or what they think is right. But why people get passionate about finding a middle ground, I think, is interesting to explore. Because it's not exactly like... I even think people have a hard time understanding why you can be passionate about finding the middle ground, because it's so like, why does that get you fired up? Do you know why?
Yes, because I don't really like conflict. So I know that, you know, and it's really ineffective. So of course, conflict is important in society, like anger. You need anger because you need people to fight for what they believe in. And so you need people to advocate for what they believe in. But then something has to happen. Otherwise, just advocate. So you need different people for, you know, doing different things. And unfortunately, you need those miserable diplomats arguing at each other a point they don't believe in. But, you know, that's just their job. And so there is misery everywhere. But we chose our own misery. And that's... That's it.
The middle ground misery plays.
The middle ground misery. Or advocate for life or something is not going to happen. Or just banging your head with, you know, with somebody else.
Yeah, I think we would agree that one thing that drove us into wanting to do mediation and conflict resolution is actually that we just hate conflict. And as a matter of fact, we avoid it at every cost. We're like conflict averse. You know, that's been something that I had to face. Like, I need to be more comfortable with conflict if I'm going to be in this field of work. That doesn't make any sense. When you and I talked the first time, you were very clear about that there's a difference between what you see as conflict and what you see as rivalry. And I think that's really interesting to unpack. Because even for me, that was a bit counterintuitive. I was like, oh, what does he mean? And then I've thought a lot about it, actually. And I think it's starting to make sense. But it would be great if you wanted to explain, maybe either, you know, you could start with defining the two, or you can explain the difference and then defining the two from your perspective, conflict and rivalry.
Yes. So I think hopefully this new answer is going to be more persuasive than the first. Because I thought about it. And... conflict is about, has to be two elements. One is scarcity and difference. with difference meaning a clash, usually of interest. And so that's where conflict arises in general. There is a condition of scarcity where there's a finite set of resources and there are two people wanting some, needing something. And there's not enough something for everybody to have. And so you need to accommodate these different needs. So there is scarcity and difference. And conflict and also added needs as kind of to encapsulate what conflict is about. And then there is rivalry. I think I would start to kind of say what rivalry means for many scholars that are studying rivalry. So they picked up that there are certain conflicts that repeat across time and they're more frequent than others. And so they basically discovered just by looking at the data that the assumption that we had that conflict is as likely to happen between you and me and you as somebody else is actually false. It can be that it's more likely between you and me because something is there. Mm-hmm. And they try to define the something. And so, and it's also more frequent, but also more long-lasting between specific actors. And I'm sure that everybody who's listening to this podcast is thinking about certain conflicts that are kind of decades long or, you know, hundreds of years long. And so it's readily understandable. For me, rivalry, differently from these scholars and differently from those who don't distinguish between, rivalry is not about needs. Rivalry is about desires. And it's not about difference. It's about similarity. And so the interesting thing about conflict is that you can accommodate your needs. There is a way, pragmatic way, to do. You produce more goods, you find more of the something you can do. And with rivalries instead, there is no way you can accommodate desires that are extremely similar. It's either you that fulfill your desire or somebody else that fulfill their desire, if the desire is speculative. And so, and now we can, you know, going on and on about how this situation can arise, situation of full-fledged rivalry, because it's peculiar. Somebody is listening to two people desiring exactly the same thing. Probably it's hard to unpack, but this is the main difference. So to answer your question in a way that is more persuasive, so if conflict is about a scarcity that is there, an existed scarcity, rivalry is about a constructed scarcity. So that's the difference. So you believe there is no alternative, but actually there's...
Right. So conflict is about needs that can be met, mostly, and conflict often arises when there isn't enough for everyone. So scarcity means that resources are finite, that they can end. They are not infinite. And rivalry is not about needs, it's about desires. It's about something that you want, don't necessarily need, but maybe you think you need it. Is that correct?
Well, that's the main philosophical difference between needs and desires.
Right.
So are they different? I would say yes. Mm-hmm. And so needs are about the body. So it's more material. When it comes to desire, it's about you and your identity, what you want to be, what you become. And these are two different things. Mm-hmm. So satisfying your body is one thing. Satisfying your desire is a different thing.
Right.
So people might experience this in different ways. Maybe they use a different language.
So conflict can sometimes be about survival because your needs need to be met. Is rivalry also about survival, or is there a connection between rivalry and survival?
Rivalry is not about survival, although it doesn't start as it's not a production or a result of this kind of condition of survival. But you can end up perceiving the situation of rivalry as a situation of existential threat, so of survival. Think about the most famous rivalries between the US and Soviet Union. It was all about it's either us or the other, and if you are not winning, we are losing. So there's an existential threat. And so it's perceived to be a survival, but to me, as an expert who tries to understand and then to transform and to, in a way, tackle the rivalry, I don't have to... The deep listening is about going beyond what the actor is saying or perceiving, so to really understand what's going on. So to answer your question, it may be experienced as such, but it is not an outcome of it.
I think it leads us into another part of your research that is called mimesis, because you're talking about desires and mimesis and desires are connected. So do you want to tell us quite like on a basic level, what is mimesis?
Mimesis is a Greek word that stems from ancient Greek. It means to imitate. Usually in the West, we believe that, or we assume that imitate is about to superficially copy somebody else. The first person I have in mind when I think about imitation is always the mime, right? So somebody is actually making a copy. There are a number of scholars, myself included, that believe and have now there are biological evidences in developmental psychology and other fields that show how powerful the act of imitation is not superficial as we believe it was. To imitate is so powerful that we use it as a way of cultural expression, but also to develop our own sense of self. It's a powerful tool that we have. And the link with our biology, this mimetic neurons we have in our mind. And so imitation allows us to not just copy the behavior, but also understand the intention behind it, the desire behind it, so that we can achieve the same task, replicate the same behavior, but just in a different way. Mm-hmm. So to achieve the same purpose, the same desire. And so it's, you know, if you open the bottle, I can open it in the same way, or just understanding that you're opening the bottle. And that's how I, thirsty as I am, I can just get some. I can be autonomous, independent.
And how do you connect this to rivalry, mimesis and rivalry?
So there is a basic assumption that I share with other scholars. It's the fact that we usually don't know what to desire. So we look at others to inform us. And so we are constantly desiring what others are desiring. And that's the twist. And it's important because it doesn't mean necessarily that desiring what somebody else is doing, it leads you to a rivalry. But in certain conditions, it does. And so what are these conditions? Basically, desiring somebody else's desire, it leads you to emulate somebody. And now I'm giving you a real-life example, right? So that you understand. So I want an academic life. And part of the academic life, or the career, is having a particular job, being a professor. Let's say that there is one university and there is one prestigious position that I can achieve. Of course, achieving that position means, for me, it means becoming more and more similar to the person who's holding that position. So that person is successful. I want to become like that person. And so I emulate that person. I publish articles, can be in the same journals or in other well-renowned peer-reviewed journals. It's the same thing. So I go about emulating this person, and this person becomes my model. Now, the rivalry arises the moment when the model strikes back. So this model, this professor decides he or she doesn't want to retire, and that's a problem because it's just one position. So this leads us to a competition. So we basically try harder to be like the best academic in order to get the job for me or to maintain the job for this person. And to the point that basically I end up perceiving this professor as my only obstacle to become like the person I really want to be. And for this other person, for this professor, I am the most threatening emulator that is out there. So it becomes, starts with simple emulation, but it becomes a matter of survival. As you know, professor with that particular status and the benefit.
When it comes to these like positions that maybe you want to acquire that somebody else has, it isn't enough just emulating that person, right? You have to become something more almost. So is it like you do the mimesis up to some level and then it's like, I don't know, trying to be more than that person in some way? And
it's trying to replace that person. So yeah. We use the term mimesis of appropriation because we try to appropriate what this person has. And so the most powerful thing about understanding how rivalry works is that while the two people in a rivalry are obsessed about the potential objects that are most important for them. I don't know, for this professor, is a particular certification in university or a particular title in university. So it's an object, it's tangible. For this person, is everything because it is all the status and the benefits that come from having that particular title. And so by taking a step back, you understand that it's never about the object, the title, but it's the desire to becoming like the other person, to replace the other. So yes, it's not just like achieving the same thing. It's a replacement. And so it can be deadly. For instance, there is a fantastic musical, The Hamilton, where at the end of the plot, there is Hamilton is killed by the other main character. And so there is one last song where this murderer now says, I knew that there was life was enough for both of us, right? So, but just after he murdered the guy.
A bit late of a realization.
Stayed late.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But at least he said it.
Yeah. Oh, it has been reported as saying it.
Exactly.
If only he had read your research before.
Yeah.
If only.
Konfliktpodden. Konfliktpodden.
Well, I want to bring us back a bit to mimesis, because now we know that mimesis can lead to mimetic appropriation, which is problematic, because that's when you want to replace someone, or that's when you are in a rivalry and your goal is to replace someone or something to reach what you think is success, basically. But mimesis, otherwise, you mentioned, is, you know, the act of imitation. We imitate and copy what others do. Actually, we learn really well from that. It's a very important way of learning. Can you tell us a little bit about how much mimesis runs our lives? Like, how often are we guided by mimesis in our daily lives?
I can use an example. I think nowadays, everybody who tries to do anything goes on YouTube and types how to do something.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah.
You have it. So mimetism is so ubiquitous. You can find it almost everywhere. And there is a course now to become an influencer, which is kind of the basic assumption is kind of taking advantage of this natural behavior that we have of imitating. These are all simple examples to just make everybody understand how our own life goes around and we learn from, you know, imitating.
So we shouldn't feel bad about imitating each other. That's actually a really important way of learning things, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's the rivalry is one out of
yeah.
imitation. But yeah, imitation can be very, very powerful. And there are many that say that even rivalry itself can be very powerful, because we had many achievements out of the rivalry between the US and Soviet Union. We went to the moon. Right? So we had other great discoveries and advancements in many, many fields. So the picture is always gray, never bad.
And just a quick mention, because you mentioned it, I think, just for our listeners, you said mirror neurons or mimetic neurons. Like, so there's actually a biological and evolutionary aspect as well in our brains that makes us want to imitate others. So they mirror
yes.
other people's actions.
Yes, there are fantastic research articles, fantastic research from scholars like Vittorio Gallese. And they discovered these neurons in chimpanzees, and they are going further in their research.
And this sounds like it happens on a subconscious level, does it?
Yes, we can also emulate consciously, but it's more powerful than we experience. So there is a lot going on subconsciously, like emotions. We experience them. We are also led by them.
Mm.
So it's so powerful that we don't have a full grasp of this particular ability that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also subconscious.
Okay. Has this knowledge about this behavior made you conscious about when it happens in your personal life? Like, can you recognize when you try to emulate people? How does that show up in your daily life?
Definitely. I have a twin, so perfect subject to emulate. So we look different. When I read René Girard, I was doing my master and I was reading a bunch of books after my first semester, and it was the winter break and I was reading one of his books. And yeah, I realized that there was a lot going on between my twin and I that was related to emulation, that was related to rivalry. And so, yes, in that case, it wasn't necessarily positive, but it's a learning experience. Yeah, and then you open up the eyes and you see how you constantly emulating in whatever you're trying to do that is deep, that has a meaning.
Okay, and what do you think you have learned from that experience? Like, how have you tried to maybe alter your behavior or thinking or anything?
I think self-awareness, it's so important when it comes to this dynamic. When you are aware that it's not just the other's fault, but actually you are scapegoat, but you have a part, a role to play, and it's also your fault, then firstly, you understand, you manage better and how you do things. And so you have a better understanding of yourself. But you also feel, you try to feel a bit different about what's going on. And so even if somebody else is giving you a hard time, you try to live it in a different way, not so, you know, such a hard way. I think it's having self-awareness about these dynamics. Really, they lift you up from the miserable state that rivalry can push you into. I'm not saying that I was miserable, but it just to give a very powerful image of where these dynamics can go.
Why do they make us miserable? Like, what is it that makes us miserable about rivalries?
When they happen, they burst into our own body and to our own relationships with others. Emotions of resentment, emotions that are deeply disempowering. And so that's what makes rivalry such a problematic aspect of our own life if you are in rivalry. And so the feeling of being miserable, I understand it as being in control of others, right? So we have completely lost agency over ourselves. That's why we feel miserable. There's nothing we can do to make this thing stop because we feel it's the fault of somebody else. That's why we are miserable. It's all about the other. And so if you end up in this state where you are powerless for a long time, you're miserable. And this feeling of being powerless, it always includes these emotions of resentment. So we resent that somebody is doing to us something we feel is unfair. Mm. And so we are unfairly treated for what we desire, for what is genuinely what we want. And we don't understand it. And we are not aware of the intrinsic social fabric of desire. The desire is ours, has always been ours. Actually, if you think about it, if there is something we believe it is our own, it's our own desire.
So now we talked about how we see rivalry on an individual level mostly. How would you say that we can see this rivalry on a more societal level?
I'm going to give you an example now because I think it's better of my own research. So I focus on Northern Ireland. And Northern Ireland is perceived to be one of the most long-lasting conflicts. It is not solved. The island of Ireland has been divided in two early 20th century. And so you have the Republic of Ireland, they got independent, and then you have Northern Ireland, which was separated from the Republic and is part of the United Kingdom. And this was the reason for it, was because there have always been two communities on the island of Ireland, the Irish community, or two main communities, and then the English community. Now, the conflict has many dimensions. There's also religious dimensions. And I'm not going to go into details of this conflict, but the state of Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom, has had for decades the dominance of one community, the Protestant community, that always strived to retain the linkages, political linkages, constitutional dependent with the United Kingdom. And then you had the Irish community in Northern Ireland that actually wanted independence. So we wanted to make also the Northern Ireland part of the Republic. And this conflict, this rivalry, went on and kind of mutated over time and acquired different aspects. And so in my own understanding of the rivalry, I usually say different objects were at stake, were contentious. At some point, there was the issue of being autonomous from Westminster, then it was about being independent, and nowadays there was the government collapse for 2 years because of the issue of the Irish language, and so you have another object of contention. But they are basically two communities striving to achieve the same desire, which is a particular nationalist desire or a project. So they want the same. One side calls it union, the other calls it nation, but you cannot accommodate or divide the territory if the desire that drive these two communities are the same. The territory, which is the object, cannot be divided. Right? It's about identity, what they want to be. And so that's why the rivalry still going on, despite the peace agreement written in 1990 that resolved direct violence on the ground. They're just different objects. The two communities are still mistrust, and there are contention still arises. Governments can still collapse after the phenomenon.
Why do you think that just that this conflict or rivalry in particular has been so hard to resolve?
Well, firstly, because it's never been called rivalry. And then when you name things the right way, then you deal them in the right way. Mm. And what do I mean with this? I mean that when it comes to a conflict, there is the idea that you get accommodate need, right? So you focus on, so you have this need. So how do I do it? That's the object you want. Okay, let's divide it. Okay, let's try to find a way to have, in this case, it's about territory. So you cannot produce enough territory. You cannot be like China, who's building up islands in the South China Sea. You cannot do that everywhere. So you try to divide it, but you cannot do it in this case. So they try to focus on accommodating the objects while underestimating the importance of transforming the relationships between the two communities. They said, let's focus on the object first, then we deal with the relationships. And nowadays, for instance, there are great projects like modules of mutual understanding that students learn both through in school. That's great. But still, they are trying to understand each other in a context where rivalry and still, you know, is pervasive. And so there's still mistrust, there is still segregation, not just in education, but also the geography of Northern Ireland is segregated. I was speaking to part of my fieldwork that I did in Northern Ireland. I was speaking to one student of Irish, of the Irish language, and she told me that she was advised to not to buy a house in a particular place because if she wanted to be Irish with her daughter, because the community was open to the Irish language, and so she was advised to buy the house somewhere else. And so it's the focus shouldn't be in about the object, should be about the relationship,
mm-hmm.
To answer directly.
It sounds like you think that they're trying to resolve it in the wrong end. They should start with the relationships before they try to resolve.
Yes, because the object is salient, is important for the two communities, only because they are desiring the same thing. Otherwise, it wouldn't be so important. It's like in certain communities, they believe that, let's use this example. For certain people, the color of the skin, so important, right? They believe that they are threatened, right, by people of a different skin color. Their status, what they are, is threatened. And so the skin color becomes salient because it becomes important. And you want, and to the point that you want in your own community people that look like. But it's changing the color of the skin is not really the issue there. And you should really think about why you want, why you feel threatened. Why do you think that this other community is threatening you? Do you have a status to defend? Mm. What does it tell about you that you think that yourself is your status?
Mm. And you're describing something that I think sounds really hard. As you said, you know, if you feel threatened by another group of people because they have a different skin color or something, or maybe a more understandable example here in Sweden is we had a lot of immigration happen in 2015. So there was this, they called it a wave of immigrants. And that, for some people in Sweden, that felt like a big threat. You know, there's people that are different from us that are coming to our territory, to our land, to our system. And I think that might be a good example of a rivalry because they are now desiring exactly the same thing that we are, like our resources, our tax money, our homes. You know, that was the idea anyway that made people feel threatened, some people. And that created quite a lot of conflict or rivalry, as we might call it instead. And in that case, to be able to put that idea of we want the object to the side and say, I want to work on our relationship is quite a big step. Like, especially when it's so polarized and you've created these people in your mind or this group in your mind that is completely different from yourself. Like, and all of our problems is their fault. As you said, that's scapegoating, saying that someone else is responsible for all of your own problems, basically. How do you even begin working? If you say the solution is to work, or a step on the way is to work on the relationship rather than focus on the object, like how do we even start there? Like they're so far away from each other and they believe they're so different.
So now, of course, we are talking about a very important issue, and usually we don't use these lenses and this perspective to understand discrimination. For me, I think I mentioned this before in the interview, self-awareness is key. And so whether you are political actor trying to advocate for a particular understanding of the relationship of what should be the relationship. So you are working in that at that level, or if you are an organization working at, you know, social level. For me, awareness of how much your projected success is what's really what's going on, right? What's is really the issue at stake there. And so if you project a particular, and I think we talked about in our conversation, I really liked this way of phrasing the issue. If you project a particular kind of success, why do you blame others for being successful in the same way? That's not the point. The point is, what societies do you want to be after that? So you have new people, you have just, your community is getting bigger. And who do you want to be then becomes a question, the real question. And the actions and the political decisions you make define your own culture. So for a community to be successful, it can be for many reasons. It's because you have a lot of oil in the sea that's close to you, like some Scandinavian countries. It can be because you are the United States and you are just big, like China. Or, you know, it can be for many reasons. For me, it's, to answer your question directly, again, self-aware. On especially from to those who are rejecting this new identity, this new way of understanding their dream. Mm-hmm. And for those who are striving and they feel miserable because they're powerless, scapegoated, just understand this is going on. And that's also a bit liberating. But yes, doesn't do much for those who are striving for success, but excluded at the same time.
Can you explain a little bit how you work with this idea of self-awareness? Because I know you do in your work with the organization Philia.
Yes, I'll try to make a link you were making, right, with society and the individual. When it comes to politics, then we are suddenly talking about leaders, right? Mm. Because society and politics have as particular actors playing out their roles. And you have state officials, politicians. And so the link is, you know, with awareness of these dynamics, it has to be found in this kind of complexity. So it's a responsibility of leaders to understand that one of the most unethical and vicious dynamic they can be trapped into is the one of rivalry. And so, and then it's a question of what society you want to be. And again, it's about political actors and leaders striving for a particular vision. For the leaders who want social change, leaders that believe that their community is stronger in diversity, then these leaders have a chance, but they have to understand what the challenges that they're dealing with. And so it is for them to understand and be aware of this dynamic so that as leaders with their movements, they can advocate in the best way to achieve the change, peaceful change. So that's the linkage. And so with Philia, I'm trying to do this precise thing. One of the things that I'm doing with them is sharing my expertise on rivalry. Philia has been willing to grant me some space to do some research. And so I'm trying also to research with them which leadership trait is most important to get to be immune to rivalry. Which leadership trait? Self-awareness is one of them. And another leadership trait I think is very important is self-acceptance. And then there is authenticity. So why these three leadership traits are important? First, if you want to be a good leader, the first thing you're going to do is to know about yourself, to know yourself, to own your own self, because that's who you are. And you're going to use it to shape society. And so the second trait, which is important, is accepting yourself. So it's not about changing your own self. That's who you are. It's about accepting who you are. And then it's about, you know, you know who you are, you accept it, and then you are authentic. So you own it. And the way you engage with others and with your community just speaks for who you really are. And you're not subversive. You're not trying to manipulate. You just genuinely try to achieve particular change. And so if you want to be a good leader, and I think being a good leader is also thriving in diversity and believing that you can solve problems, challenges, avoiding conflict, especially talking about violence, because conflict can arise and fine, because that's how you change things. If you want to be a good leader, then you have to know that rivalry is there, is a risk that you should be prepared to face, not just, you know, in society, but also as a leader, because many would be more than willing to become like you and just replace you because they want the same status, same benefits. that are granted to you when you are perceived to be a leader.
So does that mean that if you yourself in your daily life as a leader are aware of these things, you are less likely to end up in rivalries yourself because you know about, you know who you are, you know that you are driven by rivalry sometimes, and just that awareness makes it easier to navigate and avoid rivalry, maybe?
Definitely.
Do you want leaders to become more self-aware and more... They need to start with themselves before they go out there and try to change the world. Is that what you're proposing?
The answer is yes. And I also want to add that Philia works with women, especially. And so rivalry, as I said earlier in the interview, rivalry has the power to make you miserable. It's not just about feeling. Most societies on Earth are extremely patriarchal. And fighting the patriarchy can be, you know, such a very miserable effort because, you know, the more you try and the more you are pushed back. And many, you know, white dudes feel threatened by just being another gender and wanting the same opportunities, right? Mm-hmm. Why? Because they think their status is threatened. Because if they don't have all the seats on the table, then problematic. So again, it's about status. That's why you have this, again, this particular, I see with my lenses, but many lenses are fine. But with my lenses, I see it as a rivalry. And so if you are aware of this dynamic, you can feel less miserable. And definitely, as you said, or as you mentioned, you can avoid ending up into a rivalry, right? And so it's about, because self-awareness, when you practice self-awareness, is all about taking a step back, looking at yourself as an object, kind of from a third eye perspective. And then you see, okay, so I can react violently, angrily. I can be led by my emotions, negative ones, destructive ones, or I can be led by positive emotions, constructive ones. And thinking about what's best for me, not just getting obsessed with this person who is pushing me back and then ending up at each other's throat.
It sounds like almost changing from trying to change from a sense of fear to a sense of courage almost would help you tackle like difficult issues.
I think if you are being a leader for your own self in whatever is the sector, definitely takes courage. And part of being authentic is sharing yourself with others, which makes you vulnerable, effective to others. And you are vulnerable. That can be problematic. But definitely you're not trapped by fear of being vulnerable, feeling vulnerable. And so that is, you know, it can be a fearful effort, it can be problematic, but because it is, and you do it anyway, and then you are courageous. So yes.
Yeah, we talk a lot about vulnerability, me and Sarah, in this podcast, and it's something, a theme we come back to. So it's interesting to hear you talk about it as well. It sounds almost like a transformation, some sort, like how do you work with this practically? What does it look like when you work with these questions with the leaders that comes to Philia? Do you have an example of exercise?
Simulation.
You or?
Yes, I think the best way to, you know, to unpack this concept is experiential learning. So which is something is at the core of many courses and programs in mediation. So you can, you know, learn in the books. But it's all about, you know, practice. And that they simulate a rivalry, and so they try to be in the shoes of a rival or somebody that's trying to mediate. And I like especially Philia approach to this, because I mentioned it when I was talking, because I think it's very powerful. This they distinguish between, but they kind of highlight all of them, the dimension of the individual, our own self. It's always important. And then the relationship with others, and then the community. So rivalry has to be experienced as a struggle in strengthening our own self, in changing or making better the relationship with our peers, but also to strive to a particular community, the one that I was talking about, that doesn't see, that doesn't construct differences as problematic. It's the welcomes differences. There is no particular status or hierarchy of differences. You can be who you are, and you know, community thrives.
I was thinking about when you were talking about politicians and rivalry, and that they should choose a different way because rivalry is poisonous, basically, or it's just not something they should be very aware of, not driving people into rivalry. But then I thought, I feel like almost a lot of politicians are doing the opposite because rivalry is beneficial to them. So what do people benefit from being in rivalry or putting people into rivalrous positions?
Well, you are, It is interesting what you're saying, because you are saying that there is somebody who's intentionally putting, so there is an intention into it, somebody in a relationship of rivalry, of obsession. Definitely, you can manipulate people, and manipulation is a great way to achieve things in life for your own self. It's a destructive force, and manipulating others is very effective. So when it comes to rivalry, not everybody has the strength to go at your throat. So they just become miserable, burn out, and you're just using them. Rivalry is one outcome when both try with fairly equal power to replace each other. But many times there's just a lot of manipulation and people burn out and they're used. And politics, especially Western politics, is very negatively defined by toxic masculinity. So I think there are different ways of doing politics. You don't have to have that viciousness and that kind of egotistic attitude that make it what it is. Now, I always try, maybe that's the, and sorry for saying this academic word, but sometimes I find myself taking this constructivist turn. So I say, well, if politics is like it is this, then let's change politics. It's very easy to say than to do. But yes, I wouldn't take politics for granted for what it is. And there are many, especially women, who are striving to change what politics is and how it is done. And so politics is definitely dysfunctional and destructive and should be changed.
You took Western politics as an example of a system built on toxic masculinity, if I understood you correct.
Yeah.
Have you seen any example of a political system that you find more constructive?
I think any political system or any system that allows a much wider understanding politics or political leader, it's a better leader. You don't have to be a leader by, manipulating others into rivalry, into egotistically making your own way. And so leadership can be achieved in different ways. Now, there are many who talk about women in leadership position practicing leadership in a different way, which is less about themselves, more about, and this is just study, the way influential women in leadership behave. But it's not like essentializing how women are and how they are supposed to do politics. No, they're just factual that women, for instance, when it comes to mediation, when they are involved, peace agreements are more likely to last for a longer period of time. Why? Because at stake, it's not spoils of war, but the actual issues that make a difference for people, their needs. And so by tackling those issues, then you have a greater chance for the peace agreement to last for longer. So,
That was very interesting. I haven't heard that. It's
oh yeah.
that was new,
There's a
but
study,
not
I'm gonna, I will
surprising,
share with
but
you.
yeah,
Yeah, well, I'll share with you the
please.
study. There's a study where they analyzed 180 something peace agreements. They found out that basically the most important factor in the difference between certain peace agreements and others and how much they lasted, the role of women played in those agreements.
There would be one thing or two things maybe that you would like the people that have listened to this episode to take with them to their daily life. What would it be?
I think this is a very important question, and thank you for it. If there is one thing I want people to remember, podcast, is that rivalry can make us miserable, obsessed with others' lives and desires. The way to avoid it, to minimize the risk, is to nurturing your own self. Secondly, and more broadly, I think it's important for leaders to understand, and whoever aspires to be a leader, that rivalry is a unique risk. It's not like any kind of risk because of the consequences it can bring, destructiveness and viciousness. So it can bring long-lasting, deep community divisions. And we see many societies nowadays going through deep divisions. The US and the West in general is fractured by deep community divisions. Leaders should challenge these divisions. And I think in order to prevent rivalry to emerge or to transform rivalries, they have to advocate and practice values of inclusion and diversity.
Konfliktpodden. Konfliktpodden. Konfliktpodden.
It's been really interesting to have this conversation with you. We have gone on for quite a long time. Editing will be a challenge because there's so much stuff here that is interesting, and we'll have to kill some babies, probably, but or kill some darlings is the word, not kill babies.
But yeah, well, what an amazing first guest we had the honor to have on our podcast. I've learned so much. And before this podcast, I was a little bit unsure when Sarah told me this, your view on rivalry and conflict, how they were two separate things. I was like, what? But now I understand it. And I really feel like I'm going to see the world through a different lens from now on when I see conflict and rivalry and everything. So I just want to thank you. And yeah, I've learned so much today. It's been a great experience.
Thank you. I enjoyed our conversations, and I think there is nothing better than that kind of conversation that pulls and pushes and pulls you to so many different directions that you never expect or you end up.
Yeah, and
it's been a fantastic journey.
Yeah, I love your ability to go from the high and theoretical to like real life examples. That's really valuable. And yeah,
thank you for that. It's a real struggle, to be honest, because you know, it's
you can't tell you're good at it. So
yeah, we'll continue to be a struggle. But thank you for this.
Where can people find you if they want to read more about your research or want to get in contact with you or with Philia?
Exactly. I would love to share the organization contact of Philia. And they can find Philia on, it's the Philia project is called, so wearephilia.com. And for me, they just type Claudio Lanza is the first result. I'm kidding. No, it's the, if they want to find me, I am at Westminster University, so they can find me on that website by typing Claudio Lanza. I am also on Twitter. It's at Claudio Lanza with a K.
We'll link to your contact details and Philia's details in our description for this episode.
Yes.
So people can find you and the organization. Any finishing words?
I love you guys.
we love been, you too.
I love you too. Likewise.
It's been a great conversation. I love what you do.
Okay.
Goodbye. Bye, Claudio. Thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you. Bye-bye.